Welcome to Polycast, a civilization podcast focused on game strategy.
Dan Q.
Makalua.
The Mean Team.
Ed Jin.
With guest co-hosts,
Darkest Onion.
Eek.
I think we can all agree that we do have a measure for how well people play, and that's your score.
There's somewhat that.
Kidding.
Hello, this is episode 210, The Me and Team, Daniel Quick, EAG, and Mad Jin.
Yeah, no pause in between. Dan can't say his line.
Sorry, I forgot. I'm not good at this.
That's all right, we can say our line now. Line.
...
Oh, man.
Thank you for joining us for our weekly live stream from Firaxis Games. My name is Pete Murray, and I'm joined this week by Will Miller, who is the other co-lead designer for Civilization Beyond Earth. Last week we had Dave on. Thank you for coming out to talk to us today about covert ops.
Yeah, glad to be here, Pete.
This is a neat system. This is diplomacy by other means. There are quite a few changes for covert ops from Civilization V.
The central function of that system was to basically steal technologies. And there was some functionality dealing with the World Congress, but that was kind of it. It was a sort of limited way to interact with the game. Didn't have a lot of overlap with other systems. And when it came time to design covert ops, we wanted to expand that idea and make it a real meaty system. So there are a lot more things to do, really, and a lot more overlap with the game's other systems.
The reception on CFC, anyway, in response to the live stream was generally positive, including people who didn't have much of an affinity for the covert ops system predecessor, the espionage system that we saw in Civilization 4 or Civilization 5. It was confirmed towards the end, and Seek said, although I don't know if they would have answered this question if I hadn't spammed it in the chat on Firaxis's Twitch channel during the live stream, but apparently the spy agency provides 3 spies and more are available via quests, techs, and virtues, and they said the upper limit was about 10. So that's not necessarily 10.
Well, what I liked is the transparency I saw, being able to see if there's another agent in the city. I mean, how many times you've been in Civ 5 and not known if there's a spy that might resist your spy, and you have to kind of guess.
Yeah, I guess, but there's a little bit of strategy there, and it made sense. I don't know.
Well, it wasn't bad. I'm not saying it was non-transparent is what I'm saying.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a little less obvious, but yeah, B kind of makes it more obvious. Like, somebody's here and causing you trouble.
I guess given the difference in technology theme, it's plausible that you might have methods.
Well, I noticed they talked about stealing tech later. I didn't know if you had to be adjacent or if you can steal a tech way down the line or some portion of research to that tech with your spies.
That's interesting. I wonder if that'll be like as good as it was in Civ 4 or somewhere else.
Well, there was 2 different ways of getting that. There was stealing beakers and stealing actual tech, and they require much different levels to be able to do that.
Yeah, the tech was intrigue level 2, and level 1 was for science.
I see.
Oh, okay.
You have to get your intrigue levels up by doing things to get that city to have higher level of intrigue before you can even bother attempting those. And even if you attempt it, there's still a difficulty level associated with actually performing it.
Plus the turns you have to wait to find out to see if it actually is successful.
Yeah.
Now, did that pull 202 beakers from Kozlov's pile?
Yeah, it's actually important to note that it's not zero sum. So just like trade, that value is not really subtracted from the person you stole it from. It's just sort of generated and given to you.
Yeah.
And the way that we've balanced the system is that any operation that is intrigue level 3 or lower really has no effect on the player that it has been done to. It'll benefit them, and you may want to stop them from doing that for that reason, but it's not going to hurt you. Intrigue level 4 or 5 is when you get into the really damaging stuff.
And there is a level 0. There is intrigue level 0 for establishing a network and to siphon energy. So you establish a network, it gives you additional information about the city. So to me, that's kind of like, oh yeah, you know, my spy in Civ 5, it needs to move into the city before I'm able to get any information. And now in Beyond Earth, I guess now we need to actually tell it to establish a network. I guess it's busy finding a place to live underground or something like that, finding all the best places to eat on the cheap in the city that you have to tell it to establish a network.
Yeah.
Siphon energy sounds pretty sweet.
Yeah.
Because energy is the equivalent of gold, right?
Yep.
And in Civ 5, it's like, oh, do you want to buy a unit? Okay. You want to buy a building? Okay. Translates into, oh, so much.
It usually sucks, though, in other games, the money you can get.
Yeah, you can usually get it so many ways in Civ 5 that I'm kind of worried it's going to be so accessible that you wouldn't want to take any bonuses towards it.
I was more thinking along the line, just like the amount you can get from other sources relative to that.
Oh, I see.
One of the things that I have noticed is that because stealing science from people is a non-zero-sum game and you get kind of a lot of stuff for it, you can actually use that to outsource your research in a way. A new op available to us, which is called Recruit Defectors, and this is pretty neat because this gives you random military units. On a standard game, this takes 14 turns. That's quite a while to wait for something to come up.
It is quite a while, but you get, again, depending on the rank of your agent, you'll get three or so of these units. And what's interesting about this is that they're not selected from the ones that you can build. They're randomly selected from the military units that your opponent can build. So you may end up getting a unit that you can't produce yourself. You don't pull different affinities, you just pull a different class. The units you recruit are trained, shall we say, in the ways of your Civ to adopt your affinity before they're placed on the field.
Hack satellites is level 4. We knew about satellites already, but there really wasn't a lot of attention on it. And now that we see that there's a connection to the covert op system, maybe people will pay more attention to satellites because of that connection.
If successful, it will deorbit any satellite within some range of the city.
Okay.
So that can be pretty devastating if they have a lot of economic satellites. If they're bolstering their economy with lots of stuff in the air, you can cripple that pretty quickly. And that'll take a long time to reconstitute.
Then level 5, coup d'état, claim control of the city for yourself, works with capitals as well as quote-unquote normal cities or other cities, and there was some definite discussion about that particular point.
Yeah, that sounds nerfy to me, until I see it in play.
Everybody remembers the culture bombs, right? This is kind of that.
Indra Diva on CFC said, going wide is not a good option because it's harder to keep health in check. And even if you have a lot of cities, they just have to target your capital. That is usually the most attractive one, so it'll be a major blow to your empire. So it's necessary to protect your most valuable cities, I guess, with counter-spies, anti-spy satellites, and buildings. I think that's good advice in general.
If you have too much unhealth,
mm-hmm.
It'll start to affect others' effect against you. So unhealthy civs accumulate intrigue faster.
Interesting.
Yeah.
What can you do to protect yourself against somebody who's trying to take all of your cool toys?
You have to be able to defend against this stuff. And this is one of the places where a lot of the other systems in the game overlap in interesting ways. One of my favorite ways to do this is with the holomatrix satellite. If you park a holomatrix satellite above your city, it gives you 50% less intrigue in cities for op. The all-seer. It kicks all the agents out and clamps the intrigue back down to zero.
Because of the real estate that a satellite takes up, it's very hard to do both. To say park a science satellite over a science city and park an all-seer over top of it and kick everybody out. So you really are making a conscious choice at that point.
There's also the human hive, which is a wonder you can build. And
yes.
That reduces the intrigue in your capital.
It's interesting, though. Like, if you have a runaway nation, that's huge. I wonder how they have that balance. We'll see, I guess.
The negative health thing, I'm kind of concerned about that because people could abuse it by dropping their health to draw spies in and trap and counter-spy them to death.
Oh, I see what's happening.
It's a bit like outreaching as a strategy, but it could be done.
And?
I could see you doing that potentially, but you're going to be giving up a number of other things while you do that. For example, you're going to take a production hit, just like you will in Civ 5, because that was also revealed from the live stream. So if there's a production hit, right, because we know Beyond Earth is taken off of the Civ 5 engine. So I guess it would stand to reason there's probably also issues with growth.
Right. Well, with the production hit, I'd compensate with stations giving me free units, probably, if I went down that strategy.
Well, it's just a question of how much you're really getting from it.
Right.
Is it really worth its cost? And it might or might not be, depending on the exact numbers.
I guess if you had a particularly potent opponent that you know was going gung-ho with espionage and maybe the covert ops.
Yeah, they're gonna beeline the first big building for the three spies kind of player.
In that particular case, then, if you know someone is doing that and you've already put your counter-spies in there, and there's probably buildings that are going to help you with that as well, seeing as how there are buildings. We'd already know to help with health, because we talked about that on the last episode with the clinic. There could be situations where this is really annoying that I'm losing this, that, or the other thing. So if I know who it is, or even if I don't know who it is, let's see if I can expose them and get rid of them. But I think that's going to be very situational. I don't think... We hope anyway, for balance purposes, that that's going to be kind of a go-to sort of a thing that more often than not is worth your while to engage in.
Right. I noticed a few people on the forums are a little worried about the complexity of the espionage system. They're afraid they won't be able to understand it or counter it.
The covert ops system is kind of opt-in. Mm-hmm. You don't have to emphasize it. It can be extremely beneficial if you do. One of the things we wanted to avoid was to have covert ops kind of sneak up on players. Mm-hmm. You don't want to get your city flipped, a dirty bomb detonated in your city or something like that because you didn't pay attention or worse, right?
Right.
So the entry level for a city is kind of like the little stars you get in GTA when you misbehave,
when you do bad
right?
things, yeah.
To me, the understanding I don't think is a particular issue. I just think the counter is a bigger issue because that speaks to balance.
Yeah.
You play it enough, and given also the fact that Beyond Earth is based off of the Civ 5 engine, for existing Civ players, it's going to take some playthroughs to learn, just like you're going to be taking some time to learn about the different and varied mechanics as compared to Civilization 5. But if there's no effective counter, if there's no practical counter, then that just becomes troll bait.
Right. Yeah, that's just the thing. As long as it adds depth and isn't just complexity for complexity's sake, it's a good thing to have something in a game.
Oh, I agree. I'm thinking more of that B-liner that's going to recruit defectors and building up welcoming committees to take people off the map as they land. You know, real fast, aggressive play.
Yeah, maybe. We'll
see. I don't know if it'd be possible.
Especially not on the higher levels. I suspect that the utility of that, if there is any at the start, will not last very long.
Hopefully not.
Will not survive many patches. But it wouldn't surprise me if high difficulties kind of made that impractical right away. We'll see. I do have some gravitation towards cheesy type strategies in the first place, so, you know, I'm probably the wrong person to argue this in an objective manner, but yeah.
Another nice flavor with the covert ops is the tie-in to the affinity. And of course, we've talked about affinities before, purity, harmony, and supremacy. And we find out that if and when you reach level 11 of a particular affinity, then there is an intrigue level 5 moderate difficulty covert op that you can take. If you're in purity, you can detonate a nuclear device in the city that you have the covert op placed in, reducing the city's population by half. It's called the dirty bomb. Or you can call a worm strike if you're harmony level 11, which is to activate a device which attracts siege worms to a city. But unfortunately, we do not know about supremacy level 11 other than sabotage. So, of course, when I think sabotage, I'm immediately thinking, so like previous games of Civ where you could get rid of someone's production in a city and reset it to zero, although certainly to goodness sakes, sabotage is going to be stronger than that if it's to level 11 of supremacy, because that doesn't seem equitable to call Wormstrike or a dirty bomb.
Well, destroying sabotage, like wonders or buildings would, though.
Wonders
would kill me. I'm like, what? You built my pyramids.
Rage quit.
Yeah, I don't think blowing up wonders is a good plan.
I don't know. Depending on the wonder and the context of the game, that could be less damaging than having the population of a city. Especially a city like the capital. So,
what if you could do that to the mind flower, though? That would scare me.
Wow.
You know, the final ones. You just blow them up like that with a spy.
Yeah, better get some counter spies. Now, they probably won't allow that. But I was just saying, like, if you want to make sabotage good, you can make it too good.
That's true.
Hey, blowing up wonders, the only place that belongs are in the movies. Okay?
Yeah. All right. Disaster porn stuff.
Okay.
Well said.
Well, geez. Rule 34.
There you go.
So when an operation is performed by an agent, there are two calculations that are made. One is to see what happens to the agent, and one is to see if the operation is successful or not. There are a couple reasons that we did this, and mainly it's for kind of balancing purposes, so that we can, for example, lower the number of turns that it takes, but raise the risk to the agent, or raise the probability of failure.
The agent can remain undetected, be detected, be identified, or captured and killed. If you're detected, the target is informed that something happened, but not who did it. Be identified. The target is informed who conducted the operation, and the agent flees the city. So there is the possibility now, this is a variation from Civ 5's espionage, because if you were caught in Civ 5, if your spy was caught, they are gone. But there is a possibility that you can be caught and let go. And the agent is essentially allowed to flee. Now, of course, when I say allow, probably means they went to try to kill them and they were unsuccessful. But that's an interesting wrinkle. I wonder if that's, again, tied to, you know, whether the operation succeeds or fails. If it fails, depending upon the intrigue level of what you're trying to go for, the difficulty of it succeeding, I guess that's also going to come into play. And maybe your disposition as well, somehow, towards the AI. I'm thinking of the AI in particular, if the spy gets killed or the spy is actually able to flee. You know, just how pissed off are they that it was you that tried to do something, whether you were successful or not? An operation can succeed but result in a captured agent, or it may fail but allow the agent to remain in the city undetected, as noted by Ariok on his site. So yes, that is possible.
They added the possibility.
That's a nice little bit of added flavor. So I think that way, it's not always necessarily going to be double crap. I was unsuccessful and the agent was caught. There's a possibility for a silver lining here.
Yeah.
If you're playing a risky, high-difficulty game, those agents are going to be have a harder life.
It's also interesting to point out, in terms of the agent's risk, the more agents that are in a city, the higher the risk.
Interesting.
And this is to kind of rubber band sort of the dogpile effect. So you don't want big 8-player multiplayer game, everybody dogpiling into that one city. They kind of got a little bit of intrigue at the beginning. And
Casablanca.
Right, exactly.
Now, a choice for a national security project, which is a cumulative task that agents can do if they are left at headquarters. It's not just about counterintelligence being passive. Do something if and when someone tries to do something else. No, there is actually something constructive you can be doing. There's homeland security, plus 1% city strength and plus 1% city hit points for each agent at headquarters. Research and development, plus 1% production for wonders for each agent at headquarters, and also still each agent at headquarters. Propaganda, plus 2% health. Operations support, lowers the risk to covert agents. And operations reconnaissance, increases the chance of operation success.
Well, support and reconnaissance are really more attractive to me as options than the small percentage bonus, especially if we're talking 10 or less spies, as was suggested in the video.
Yeah, I'm immediately drawn towards the support or the reconnaissance. Either lowers the risk of covert agents doing operations or increases the chance of operation success. But then again, percentages, we know that earlier on in the game, percentages were more like, meh, I want an absolute total here. And then there's that kind of sweet spot at some point, right, in the mid to late game when you're like, an absolute value, I want a percentage. Because when the city itself is established and you already have decent base production, then you would like to be able to leverage that decent base production to some particular percentage. So maybe the ones that are percentage-based is a little more of a slow burn as the game goes on. I don't know. It's not clear if you can switch the national security project at any time. And if you can, well, then I don't know.
Well, they said you can switch it every 3 or 4 turns, I think, in the video.
Oh, okay.
To keep people from flipping every turn for what they need exactly micromanaged on that turn.
Someone could even say even every 3-4 turns is kind of a level of micro. I guess it's just to eliminate being completely ridiculous versus not having it at all. I wonder, is that supposed to scale with game speed?
I think it does, actually. It would be kind of schizophrenic to have it like one turn, because, I mean, you wouldn't be able to tell what the person was doing on every single turn. You have to go back and check their setting each time.
There is actually a quest associated with this. So when you complete the quest for your eyes only, which is pretty cool, you've received an encrypted message from the Culper Cell.
The Culper Cell, there's a series of quests that are given out to you as you do more covert ops-related things. The Culper Cell's interest in you will increase as you get new spies and do operations, and they'll hand these quests out to you. And the Culper Cell, the idea behind them is that they're a clandestine organization that followed you from old Earth.
I just keep thinking of the Stonemason song from The Simpsons.
The first 100 turns.
Yes, the Solar Gamer, first 100 turns playthrough.
Sid Meier's Civilization Beyond Earth. That's right, I got a chance to play the first 100 turns of Beyond Earth. Now, I did go down to San Francisco, all expenses paid from 2K Games itself. I have to say that for legal reasons. But yeah, this game is fantastic. So what this game does is combines, I'm not going to say it combines Alpha Centauri with Civilization 5, but literally that's the gist of it. This is not Civilization 6. This is its own new IP that Firaxis has been working on that combines Alpha Centauri with Civilization V. And I think they did it well. Let's explore this alien world. I have to say, I really enjoyed this playthrough that I did.
It's a little over an hour long, I believe.
That's correct.
Yeah, 67 point something minutes. So
yes, split into two parts.
Yep.
I noticed that the ships actually have the letters FRXS on them when the civilization lands. I thought that was kind of cute.
Oh, yeah. That's a nice little subtle nod to Firaxis.
Yeah.
I'm surprised I didn't notice it before, to tell you the truth.
Well, that's because you were paying attention to probably more practical things. And then while you're waiting for to learn about more practical things, your mind starts, again, parsing every pixel.
I think the tech web will be an adjustment for a lot of people because just it looks different. It might not be that complex, but it's just so different from what you're used to looking at that that'll take a moment, I think. Some of those worms look really sturdy. They're a real pain just taking a gander at this.
One thing that I didn't notice until right now is that there is a gigantic siege worm on its way to my capital. And these siege worms are badass. They are humongous. Look at how much damage that's going to... Like, nothing. That's not going to do shite. They're scary.
Solar Gamer, he's got about 76,000 subscribers on YouTube. And yes, there were some other playthroughs. And one in particular we're not going to talk about. There were some issues with the delivery, shall we say. So I chose this as, from what I've seen, I'm able to come across a decent example. And now it's hard to say if it's the best because, well, how do we know there aren't more first 100 turn videos to see before the game is actually released?
Yeah.
I think my favorite comment, and the Solar Gamer just responded perfectly. Robert Glover on YouTube is like, wow, can this guy say cool one more time? Sheesh. Solar Gamer's response? Cool.
Yeah, there you go. Roll time.
He's like, yes.
Yes, I can. Thank you.
Something I noticed in a lot of these 100 turns we've seen, everyone wants to kill the sea alien, right? And I have never seen a sea alien actually attack a city or a worker unit or anything. And because we've never seen really boats or embarked units much until a little bit in Solar Gamer.
I think that's what we call preemptive strike.
Maybe.
Can you just way kill everything? I thought that's how it worked. I don't understand.
My concern would be like, let's say you just shoot the alien whales, like he calls them, and you just make the whole alien life angry because you're afraid, even though you're one tile in from the coast, like he was.
Well, I think you're just trying to piss the aliens off for everyone, right? I mean, that's the way to go.
Ah, hate play.
Well, there's also the fact that the aliens think they're the boss on this planet, seeing as how, you know, it's their planet, and they need to know about the New World Order.
You could make a case for doing that, though, if you're going a very military-oriented opening and your opponents aren't, because then the pissy aliens will mean less to you than them, in theory.
Well, it's like Raging Barbs in Civ 5. You can feed yourself science by making them all angry at you.
Yeah, there you go.
No matter what your affinity is, and no matter how aggressive the aliens are towards you, if you get in range of their alien nest, they will attack you no matter what. You know, it's kind of a defensive territorial thing. They will attack you. Now, I just knocked that out, so they're going to be really mad at me. Which is fine. I mean, they'll get over it. And that siege worm is still kicking around my base, which is quite terrifying, but we'll deal with that eventually. Oh! He's attacking, and he wipes out my entire Ranger squad, which I was just so surprised when that happened, because I shook the screen. These aliens are so powerful. It's great. It's absolutely great. It's going to add another element to the game. So, let's see what we can do. Yes, we can kill the siege worm if we attack it right now. No, we didn't. He's still alive. Well, you might as well just risk it and go for the sailmate. Come on, kill it. Whoa.
Josh Hines on Facebook said, definitely the best playthrough commentary I've seen so far. Now, Greg Spencer's like, I've given up watching any first 100 turn videos. You've shown so many to try and prove it isn't a bore that we're going to know everything about it by release, and it'll be boring anyway.
Right. Well,
what?
Well, he said a few times in the video in his defense that he wasn't playing his best game. He was playing his... I want to show you combat game. So I think he did a good job warning people it wasn't going to be alpha or best strategy.
Well, he's there to inform, but he also has to entertain as well.
True.
The Pan-Asian Cooperative doesn't like how we're being... Yep, and Brasilia doesn't like how we're being mean to the aliens around us. Our continued conquest of the aliens is going quite swiftly. However, I want to turn my attention towards Brasilia soon enough. I think I'm going to do that after I kill that alien nest that's down in the bottom left-hand corner. So those aliens are dead. Perfect. Now, one of the things that I hadn't really considered beforehand was the fact that all of that miasma that's right below Freeland is really going to play a huge factor in how wars are commenced in this game. Because miasma is a definite environmental hazard, and it will cost you to lose wars based on attrition. So you really have to think about where you're going to attack from to really attack these cities without losing as much damage. Okay, yep. And that siege room just came out of nowhere and attacked us and destroyed our rangers. Dang, that sucked. That really did suck. But our marines are on the job, and we're going to take them out because vengeance and all that stuff. Yep, there we go. Vengeance.
Even if they are, like, a below-average player, like, people enjoy their content. You know, maybe you're not watching for elite play. Maybe you're watching if you, like watching this person play.
Better than him, then
you're not getting your entertainment value from his skill, but from something else. And that's fine.
Well, no, it's actually even funnier. It's like, if you don't like the way this guy plays, why are you constantly watching the stream?
Right.
I love the small animations. I love the small details that are put into the game. So, like, the city artwork, it looks fantastic. The water, the miasma, it just everything all together just makes me love this game. It really does. Firaxis is great with their support of the games, and I think they'll do an amazing job.
Welcome to the Firaxis Mega Panel for Sid Meier's Civilization Beyond Earth.
My name's Lena Brenk. I'm the lead producer.
I'm Anton Stringer. I'm the gameplay designer.
I'm Will Miller. I'm the co-lead designer.
I'm David McDonough. I'm the other co-lead designer.
I did see an interesting terrain feature. I guess that's an odd place to start, but I saw a caldera on the map. I hadn't seen that before. I'm not sure what the yield was. There was a ring of mountains in the middle of a huge lake, but you could see it was a crater. So it could also be a city that used to be there. You know, I mean, they could have gone that direction, but I wasn't sure what I was looking at.
Yeah.
Did anyone else notice that there was a borehole improvement possible far down in the game?
No.
It was a kind of nice homage to, I thought, Alpha Centauri to have any Purity 8 for it.
I know the developers have said that there would be homages to Alpha Centauri, and a lot of that I can understand.
How could there not be?
You know, oh, exactly. They would just be remiss not to do that, I think.
Right. I like the Rocktopus, too. I'd only heard little things aside about it. I hadn't heard a lot of good information on it. I've never seen an orbital biological unit that also floats on the ground temporarily. I have to check that out.
There are designer life forms, which lets you make the Rocktopus, among other things.
Did you just say Rocktopus?
I did say Rocktopus. If you watched the first Firaxis live stream, you hopefully were treated to an extensive explanation by Anton where that name came from.
We thought someone would change it, and no one did. Yeah. The funny part of that was that we got pretty late in production, right about the time when we needed to make sure that all our ducks were in a row, and Anton comes in one day and he says, "Guys, are we shipping this game, calling it the Rocktopus? Guys, is this what we're going to call it?" And Dave and I
were like, yes.
We're like, yeah, of course.
To hear from the developers themselves and some of the thought processes they put into it, I think it gives you a better understanding of what they were trying to go for with the gameplay.
The fungal biome here, we've shown off two biomes already, the lush biome, which is very terrestrial, the arid biome, which looks like something straight out of Frank Herbert's Dune, and this one, which is, I think, the most bizarre and strange of the environments that you can play in. The biome is just one of the aspects of our map generation system. Underneath that are the map scripts, which we've written to make really interesting gameplay environments for you to play in, and those are also moddable, so we're really excited to see what our team can do there. I think all Civilization games make some philosophical statement to their players. And Civilization in the past has said, you know, what if? What if this combination of things were true? What if Gandhi had nukes or Genghis Khan was an economic powerhouse? Or, you know, there are these kinds of scenarios that you set up in Civ. And what this game asks is, what is next? Like, given a thousand years from now, what do we look like? Who are we? Do we even resemble the human beings that we are today?
Well, it reminded me that there's a kind of people behind the game. I know that sounds silly, but a lot of my friends, they think of it like feeder bar, give me my game. They don't realize there's a personality behind it.
No, exactly.
Which is why I like the funny stuff in some of the videos where other people groan. I'm just like, they're trying to enjoy themselves.
David and I had been ruminating on diplomacy for a while, and he came in one morning just ecstatic because he had thought of a way to add something cool to diplomacy. The problem was, it was after content lock. It was close to, you know, another major deadline. It was like, we should not be adding features to this game right now. Mm-hmm. But we did, and we just didn't tell anybody about it.
Such a small change.
Luckily, it turned out really well. Luckily, it didn't.
What do you mean, luckily? This is, we knew what we were doing.
Don't
sometimes.
Show worries.
apparently Esper is going to be a little late delivering Beyond Earth on Linux and Mac. Not infinitely, like some dumbass person wrote.
Yeah.
They used a word technically correct.
No,
but not
even
good
not,
for connotation.
Actually, it's not even technically correct. Indefinite.
Oh.
Is not the technically correct. It is delayed. That is the only technical correctness. Saying that it's indefinitely delayed leads you to believe that it won't come out in the end.
The vaporware curse is what they're afraid of.
Yeah, so either this was a fail on the grasp of the English language, or clickbait, or maybe both.
Mm. It was mostly both.
2K Games also issued a statement, which was, "We remain committed to both Mac and Linux versions of Beyond Earth, but we don't have a release date to share just yet. It will happen. Stay tuned."
Yes, which is totally different than indefinitely delayed.
Yeah.
It will happen.
Well, and Firaxis said, "Mac and Linux versions are coming soon." So, yeah, I don't know how you get indefinite from that. Yeah.
Well, these days, I try really hard to stay out of the Mac PC / Linux debate because people get really angry really fast. So I tend to skirt along with, they'll come eventually.
Hmm. It'll show up.
Quantum Troll, like everyone, release it earlier for those two platforms.
That'd be hilarious.
week.
That would be funny. Yeah, but their original aim was to have all released at the same time. And that's obviously not going to happen.
Well, I mean, I'll probably refer people to talk to Aspire by email rather than, like, you know, beat up Firaxis for the situation, based on what's been said anyway.
Well, you can't necessarily blame Esper for it. You'd have to know why they got delayed first.
Yeah, right.
Any number of a million different reasons.
So. Well, it's just I'm really sensitive to Firaxis hate when I see it, because it's usually just real quick off-the-cuff comments.
Well, everybody blames Firaxis, even though most of the time it's 2K's fault, and they just don't understand the difference between the two.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, 2K is kind of the link between Firaxis and Aspire here on things like that. So if you're going to blame anybody, although I think blame is a pretty strong word,
right. Then
yeah, I guess you're most accurate to point the finger at 2K. But even then, without knowing the particulars, I really don't know what you're pointing the finger at.
Yeah, right. If you don't know why, stop pointing fingers.
Without going too far out, I've seen the theme forums for BE, and there's a lot of what's a producer and what's a developer problem, but most people don't know how to differentiate, like you guys were saying.
Yes, so a Polycast education moment. Oh no, everyone run, we're going to learn something.
Uh-oh.
No!
Game developer equals Firaxis. Game publisher equals 2K Games. For Civilization. I better add that qualification.
I'm not saying that
they're the only developer and publisher on the planet.
Yeah,
maybe as far as we're concerned, that's what you think.
Firaxis Sports, Madden 2016.
So there's been a discussion about follower beliefs, choosing a follower belief that is not a building or structure purchased by faith, trying to see if there's any other options that are better and when to pick them.
Yeah, Red Axe in this thread, it's more than just, you know, I tend to look at things other than religious buildings because the AI likes to go for them and I may not necessarily be the first to get a religion, so they take it first, so I have to consider something else. But even if I do have the option to get one or more religious buildings, should that really be my thinking? Which I think is even more what he's getting at when he says rethink. We're always like, oh, I better have a backup plan just in case what I want is taken. Of course, when I think of that in the context of religion, I think of more Reformation beliefs than follower beliefs. Screw you, AI, taking my Jesuit education. I'll punch you in the face.
Yeah, it is a thing.
Anyway, just to run down what these buildings are. Cathedrals, plus one faith, plus three culture, plus one happiness with an artist specialist. Monasteries for plus two faith, plus two culture, or more with wine and incense. Mosques, plus three faith, plus two culture, and plus one happiness. Or the pagoda, plus two faith, plus two culture, and plus two happiness.
Well, with me, with religion, just to touch on it quickly, I either commit to a heavy religion at the beginning, or I don't mess with it too much. So it's hard for me to pick anything but pagodas, usually, if I'm going for a building.
To me, if an AI gets a building before I do, even if it's a building I wasn't thinking about necessarily choosing, I think, oh, it's off the table in case I decide later on when I enhance if perhaps I would have liked that. So after I say a few curse words, I then say to myself, I wonder if I can move that much closer to that AI in the hopes that that religion will spread
right
to me. So at least in some of my cities, I can be able to construct that building with the faith I've accumulated otherwise. And then if I have my own religion, then bring that religion in. And maybe there's also another religious building that I can construct. And I think we've said even recently on the show, we've reminded our listeners that if you construct a faith building because you have religion X in the city and then religion X goes away and religion Y replaces it, or even if you lose the dominant religion period, that building from religion X doesn't go away.
Exactly. I tend to manage my diplomacy by allowing my neighbor to convert me lately. So it's harder to convince myself to go strong religion and try to push it on them.
And then the other balance of the consideration was, in terms of the faith that you have to spend in order to then get the building, there seemed to be some focus from Red Axe and others in terms of, well, how long is it going to take in order for you to be able to get that faith back? You know, if you spend 200 faith on a building and you're going to get 2 faith from that building, then, oh my gosh, look at the 100 turns you're going to have to take in order to get that faith back, except that you're not just getting faith back. The faith generation you get from the faith buildings just kind of goes back into the collective pool. To me, it's more about the culture and the happiness. In particular, the happiness.
Yes.
aspect, because that happiness feeds into your growth. It feeds into your production. It can feed into culture. It can feed into faith. It can feed into whatever quantity X is, whatever it is that you are going for. Are you on the defensive? Are you on the offensive? Culturally, scientifically, militaristically, all of those three or some combination thereof otherwise, it doesn't matter. Now, does that mean that I would always choose a religious building? No. As is pointed out in the thread, if you have a religion but your faith output is particularly low, then think about, well, how many of these buildings am I most likely going to get during the course of the game? You may be better off with something else like choral music for +2 culture in cities with 5 followers, or religious centers which provide +2 happiness in cities with 5 followers. So in that way, if you took choral music or religious center as your first follower belief and then accumulated enough faith to enhance it, now you could have a temple that's giving you +2 culture and +2 happiness, and to a degree now, minus the faith accumulation, right there, you've got a pagoda replacement.
Yeah. Well, I started liking the +1 to shrines, +1 happiness to shrines, because it's cheap to build to get happiness out if you're going for a wide plan.
And the fact is, by the time you take that, you've already got shrines probably, because that's how you manage to get a follower belief in the first place.
Well, another concern I have with buildings sometimes is if I'm going on a great person strategy, I'm like, do I really want to do buildings and great people? If I'm going for science victory, for example, late game.
If you want to accumulate faith for buildings and accumulate faith for great prophet or missionaries, I'm not going to get that well of a spread on my religion. So it doesn't really matter if I'm trying to build up to get buildings.
I have the same problem sometimes, so I understand what you're coming from.
Yeah, I'm often never, and people who've listened to this show before know that I love to found my own religion. And yes, I generally would love to get a religious building. I'm not often thinking about necessarily spreading my religion to somebody else, except perhaps a city-state or two.
Right.
That's nearby me, just because I would rather focus on what can I do with regards to my faith for something that I have a bit more control over. I mean, some of the other options that I would tend to take if, say, the buildings are gone. And for me, I do prefer a pagoda over a mosque. Even though, yeah, mosque is going to give me more faith, I do get +2 happiness instead of +1 happiness. And again, I'm not constructing the faith building to, strictly speaking, be able to generate more faith. That's what my shrines and temples are for. And if that's a way, those two are gone. Cathedrals, with the +1 happiness, +1 faith, and +3 culture, unless I'm feeling particularly culture deprived and I'm not really much, you know, like a cultural victory kind of player, I would rather not even choral music or religious center, to be honest. I'm not often at that point thinking about a religious building replacement, but if those buildings are gone and I have a high faith output, which would then kind of lead me to want a religious building, but, oh, I've got the third or fourth religion, or I got the second religion, but, oh, crap, I only got one building, you know, because someone else enhanced before me, you know, Gur and Arg, then, I mean, as a militaristic player, Holy Warriors, for instance, for faith for purchasing pre-industrial land units, that is a lot more attractive. Or if I've got a particularly tall Empire, I might be more inclined for Feed the World, for shrines and temples to provide plus one food in each city. So my religious buildings that are generating faith is also generating food, so my cities can be taller and I can again work more tiles for more production and generate more science. I think out of all of the follower beliefs, I know someone, I think John C. Nunn kind of poo-pooed the swords into plowshares because he said if an AI declares war on you, then goodbye-bye for the plus 15% faster growth rate in each city. But I actually think that the one that I just kind of go, I don't think so, would actually be divine inspiration. I mean, each world wonder provides plus two faith in the city. When compared to the other options, I mean, it's not bad, but if you're not gung-ho wonder building or taking a lot of cities that have a lot of wonders, I'm not really sure that's worth the while.
Well, no, sometimes when I enter, like you say, you want to found that religion, and then I suddenly realize the Celts and Ethiopia are in the game, I kind of get sigh really loud and go, never mind, and have to change course. Does that ever happen to you?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, there are times when I have to be able to respond to the changing circumstances that my plan is going to have to change. Maybe that does mean that, hey, there are times I'm going to end up choosing a follower belief that I wouldn't normally choose. But I still don't think that but going back to what Red Axe is asking here, a rethink on religion follower beliefs. If he says to me strictly the question about, well, should religious buildings be my first consideration? Maybe it shouldn't be my first consideration. If I have the choice, I'm more likely than not going to want to choose a religious building unless I'm not generating that much faith. But typically, if I am generating a lot of faith, I'm first or second to a religion. So therefore, the options for the religious buildings are still there, or at least one of them.
Well, I'm slow to the religion game sometimes, so I just give up on some of the buildings when I'm too far behind the curve.
But as you said, if you're later on and you're looking at your beliefs, it's like, okay, I've got to change what I'm thinking. What is it that I'm going to be getting out of religion? Because if you are founding it late, then regardless of what your belief is, you're not going to be able to leverage that like you would have been able to leverage it if you had your religion 20, 40, 50, 100 turns ago.
Exactly.
I think maybe just to conclude this point, I think the one follower belief that does get overlooked, peace gardens, where they give you plus two happiness in a city. Because the garden itself, yes, I think it gets overlooked because you're not going to be able to be constructing a garden in every city. Although, if there's one civilization that you can construct garden in regardless of whether you've got access to water?
Candy of the Indonesian civilization doesn't require fresh water.
If you have a smaller empire, if you're more tall as opposed to wide and you find yourself on bodies of water and you can get that early on, the fact that that's giving you plus two happiness in the city, you don't have to then worry about so much what your faith generation is. If you've got low faith generation as well, you don't need the faith then in order to be able to purchase those gardens. You can purchase them yourself or actually outright construct.
Well, especially with Brave New World, I mean, honestly, the amount of money you can have available is ridiculous. Maybe even too much so sometimes, if you angle it right. I buy more by money than I ever have by faith.
Venice is a menace.
Exactly.
Gosh, this game, it's so vast. Prozac 1964 is just commenting that Civ 5 is vast and hard to master, I guess.
Got the plateaus you're going to go through.
Yeah.
Well, how could I ever hope to master every aspect of the game? Wow, talk about setting yourself up for some disappointment.
No kidding. I know I have, and I'm still like, oh, every now and then about something.
As long as you're not like you every once in a while.
Just read the manual.
There you go.
Read the manual, man.
If only.
See, there are these things called manuals. And what you would do.
Well, I mean, there's a type of player, and I'm not getting down on them, that doesn't read the manual and additionally doesn't read the Civipedia or how anything works, and then they're mystified when a game effect happens.
So what works me, though, is like when I wind up mystified after I have read those things because the things I read are inaccurate.
Oh,
that's what I start getting.
Or you've interpreted them to be more OP than they are, and you're like, oh, and you realize you made a mistake.
Well, no, that's on me. But if there's just something in there that's blatantly wrong, and I made a decision based on an in-game representation of something that wasn't the case, that's different territory than we're talking about here.
Akin does say, practice makes perfect. To be honest, we all started here. The good news is that once you quote-unquote master this game, jumping on the next one is easy. Whoa. There's an assumption. Because to me, I've mastered Civilization 4. Hey, Civilization 5, that's easy to master you now, right?
No.
No.
He said...
Master, no.
He didn't say mastering. He said jumping on.
Well, do you just throw the game on the ground and...
Exactly.
Jump away.
It's not that really difficult. I don't know why you need to master the other game first.
You hear a lot of people saying like Civ 4 from stacking to one unit per turn, and they act like, well, that's going to be easy. I'm like, no, it is not.
You mean one unit per tile, right?
Yeah, the one unit per tile. Yeah.
One.
Imagine is the one that talks about one unit per turn. I'm waiting for that mod. I'll tell you what.
Oh, yeah.
I like Prozac 1964's response to Akin, which was, thanks. It's encouraging to hear more experienced players say that. I can't wait for it to all snowball. And then Dr. Vic Tim says, I put a city in the snow and it didn't snowball.
Nice.
The question they asked is, which good players are switching to Beyond Earth? Now, qualify this. If you are not a good player, you are not allowed to post in this thread.
Exclusion.
And if you are not a good player, no one cares.
This just ties back to the average player thing. You can't possibly begin to measure that. So,
well,
and surprisingly, there are actually two pages worth. So some people actually think they're good players. It's great. Well, but anyways, he does ask, he has not really played Civ 5 for some months now. He's planning on switching to Beyond Earth when it comes out. So I guess he's assuming he's a good player.
He only wants the opinions of good players that he can become one at some point.
Ah, see, that's also a good take. In general, he's just excited that there's some new turn-based strategy game to play competitively, and who else is planning on leaving Civ 5 behind and going to Beyond Earth, which sort of sounds like the whole premise of leaving Earth behind and going beyond.
This one just kind of seemed to me like, with having too many hours in Civ 5, that I would probably be starting to be happy with it's like Civ 5 but new with BE. So I won't leave Civ 5, but I'll probably play a lot more BE for the first few months at least.
Are you a good player?
That's hard to say.
Are you allowed to answer that question?
The answer is yes.
I'm good enough, I guess is what I'd say.
I don't know. The thing is, if you switch to Beyond Earth, then okay, once Beyond Earth is out, then you are done with Civ 5. I could see someone switching to Beyond Earth and then for one reason or to other going back to Civ 5.
Yeah, I could actually think of a good reason why people would go back to Civ 5 after playing Beyond Earth. But I probably can't say that.
Well, I understand.
I was about to say, how awkward a silence are we going to have right now? You did not see the look I just gave you, sir.
There's a cone of silence descending during your comment there, man.
Like, I can think of reasons, but I don't think I can say.
Well, I could see someone like finding a rage quit moment that continues to happen to them in Civ BE, and then grumbling, throwing their mouse, and just going right back to Civ 5 for a few weeks to calm down.
Yeah.
You know, exactly. I know that kind of player.
Before Civilization 5 was released, I would have said, yes, I think if you are, I don't know about the good player thing, but when the new Civ comes out, you're done with the last one. But then Civilization 5 came out, and it was different enough from Civilization 4 that I still found it enjoyable to be playing both. Now, is this an exact comparison? Because it's not Civilization 5 versus Civilization 6. Despite some people's like, oh, Beyond Earth is Civilization 6 instead of Civilization 6.
Reskin! Oh, throw that in there.
I also think that because it is based off of the Civ 5 engine, that to say that you're switching to Beyond Earth, I don't know if that's the word.
Transitioning is what comes to mind for me.
Yeah.
It feels like shift into the new game. Not to tangent too far, but when Civ 6 does come out, I think it'll be harder to decide whether to 5 BE to 6. You know, how to balance what I'm going to play at that point.
Bring in a few 4 elements too.
Yeah.
Bring them all in. Evaluate everything.
I don't know about that.
Only people who've played Civ 1 can find out whether or not you're allowed to play Civ 6.
Nice.
Although, quite frankly, the switching to Beyond Earth, it's not the same comparison. I mean, it's the same in the sense that it's based off of the same engine, but one's about historical Civ and the other is sci-fi Civ.
Yeah. Right.
Well, it's also the question of, are you going to stick with BE? I mean, yes, people will go, and if we blatantly ignore the word that good that he threw in there, are people going to go play BE and stop playing Civ 5 because BE is what they want to play? I think a lot of people go play BE for a while whenever it comes out.
Try it out.
Yeah, short-term answer, that's easy.
But then that will eventually slip back to playing both, probably, because they're two different games.
Well, the people that consider carrying the historical pitchfork in Civ, they're only going to play if it's history, probably are going to avoid BE entirely from what I've seen on the forums.
And therefore, we don't care about their opinion anymore.
And especially in that thread, particularly.
Yeah.
You know, not going to switch. Thanks for saying. On we go.
Yeah. They know the people who are like Matt Haxor. At this point, I'm not even buying it. It looks like it's purely just a reskin of Civ 5. And it's just like, okay, but...
Like, A, we didn't give a damn that your opinion in the first place on that, because that wasn't the point of the thread.
Well, I've been fighting the reskin argument on Steam and on the forums, and I've just given up to, no, it's not going to explain.
Don't feed the trolls. Just make them go away.
Right.
Whereas, you know, Buccaneers, like, I have absolutely no interest in Beyond Earth due to its sci-fi futuristic themes. Mm-hmm. But that doesn't mean it's a bad game or does not have interesting gameplay elements. It would not come as a surprise to me at all that, for instance, Beyond Earth, just like Civilization V, will both influence what becomes Civilization VI. For better or worse, we could also argue that for hours on end. We could ask 10 people and get a dozen different opinions, but it's all going to be part and parcel with that.
I thought that was a really nice thing to say in a thread. I mean, I almost thought I wasn't on the internet when I read that.
If places like CFC, etc., reinvigorate the concept, i.e., do we get Games of the Month? Do we get the challenges? Do we get the Hall of Fame? Does Civ players actually build up a multiplayer community again for like the ladders and stuff like that? If all of that actually happens, then it will have a bit more staying power.
I study sociology, so I've discovered that what usually happens in games like Civ is it happens again. It's a repeating thing like history. So I'm pretty sure we're going to see a lot of the same phenomenon happen again, like you're talking about there.
Well, I don't know. I mean, the Hall of Fame guys actually said they weren't sure.
I hadn't heard.
Yeah, they weren't sure, but I mean, realistically, they want to go and check it out first and then see if they can.
Well, that was the right response. How could they even begin to be sure when the game isn't even out yet?
Yeah.
Right.
But of the phenomenon that you have observed, Dark Onion, would one of those happen to be that there seems to be a correlation between purchases and subsequent playing of a game when it goes on sale?
Exactly. But I've also seen there's a certain crowd, they go, oh, there's a new Civ game, pre-order.
But I would suggest that there is going to be a bit of competition this time. Unlike the base game Civ comes out, there is no competition because no one actually tries to build a game similar to Civ. They figured out a long time ago that they should just stop doing that. But when it comes to this sort of thing, which is futuristic colony on a future planet, there actually are multiple games coming out at around the same time that are basically in the exact same space of Civ in future.
Well, yeah. First off, there was this thing about the 15-year wait between Alpha Centauri and Civilization Beyond Earth. And there was also this fact that Civilization base games kept coming out every few years and or expansion packs.
Right.
And essentially after Alpha Centauri and then at least right now the effective demise of Master of Orion, some new players in the market have emerged, including but not limited to the Galactic Civilization series.
Right. I mean, that's what comes to mind, Galactic Civ for me.
That was a long round way back when too. Galciv 1 was out around the same time as Mu.
Yeah. And I dropped in at 2 for Galciv, but I was a big Mu fan, like, forever, so I didn't know about Galciv until much later.
Even that's not the correct thing I'm talking about. Anyways, you don't compare a 4X TBS space game to what Alpha Centauri was. Alpha Centauri was Civ in space.
Civ in space. Kind of like
a turn-based strategy space game, which is like the comparison to Mu.
Right, there's a separation.
Yeah, there's a difference between being on planet and not being on planet. And what I'm talking about is there are games like Pandora. There is a game called Endless something or other.
Endless Space, I think it's...
Not Endless Space. That's the Mu style. Endless Legend, I do believe. People who make Endless Space are making a game called Endless Legend, which is basically like BE in that it is a colonizing a planet, etc., etc., in the future. And obviously, BE is going to be the one from the only developers who actually know what they're doing with it. Yeah,
it's a AAA offer.
Call in today. In North America, the number is 301-637-7659.
That's 301-637-POLY.
In Europe, 44121-288.
7659. That's 44121288-POLY.
The only thing worse than being talked about is not being talked about.
For more information on Polycast,
our sibling shows Modcast, Revcast, and Turncast,
or about Polycast in general,
log on to the series' official website at thepolycast.net.
I'm already expecting someone to say, so if Beyond Earth is based on the Civ 5 engine and you put that in Beyond Earth, where's our Civ 5 patch that allows that in Civ 5? You know it's coming if it's not already out there. I may have encouraged it. I'm sorry.
I wouldn't be shocked to see the mod community come after BE and backdate a few things to Civ 5 for people.
Yeah. And they'll all be shut down because that's blatantly illegal.
Yeah, I know.
Is it?
I know they'll try.
Yep, they're two different products. Anybody who copies one out of one copyrighted product and puts it into another is actually performing something rather illegal.
That's interesting, because like some of that stuff you could just guess would be in, and if you're modding it yourself, you're not like just strictly copying stuff. I think that's great.
No, it's not great.
It's pretty black and white, from what I understand. That's why I kind of brought the idea up.
Because somebody actually on the forums at one point did mention copying BE code and dropping it back in Civ 5.
Well, yeah. I mean, that should be pretty obviously illegal. I was thinking along the lines of providing similar features through your own mod work, not just copy-pasting code.
Centauri mod.
If you actually write all the code by yourself without actually looking at the BE code, then you'll have more options on defending yourself. But realistically, the IP, which is the thing that is protected, already exists, and it's obvious that it's in BE, and therefore it's obvious that what you're doing is just effectively copying the IP, even though you rewrote the code by yourself. That's really hard to defend.
I guess.
The onus will be on the person to actually prove that they didn't just, hey, I saw it in this game of yours and decided to put it in this other game of yours. And no, seriously, I didn't just look at your code.
What if they saw it in this other game that also had the feature?
Right. There's a lot of argument, but if copy pasta lawsuit, I prefer to avoid lawsuit.
Yeah. Well, the easiest thing is just to not do it.
I'm sure somebody somewhere will try and post it on Steamworks and other workshop, and then it'll just get taken down by the mods.
Yeah.
The co-host for episode 210, the main team.
Hey, my tech web, it's amazing.
Matt Jin.
Darkest Onion was here.
whoa, have you tattooed yourself into Matt Jin or something?
No, I didn't mean to do that. Sorry, man.
Awesome. What the?
Step aside, Matt Jin. Dark Onion.
That was awesome.
Just run with that. That'll work.
Darkest Onion.
Not sure what to say now. Sorry, I'm lost on that. I had fun. Nice to meet all you guys.
Dan Quick.
The Space in Between.
Oh, and myself, Eeg. Thank you for watching.
And listening.
Are people watching you, Eeg? Because that would be creepy.
That'd be one heck of a hack.
You don't know what people are doing.
Siege Worms just ate my worker. So he's actually building his spy agency now. No doubt feeling he's missing out on something very exciting at this point.
No, there is actually something constructive you can be doing. And I get an ad right at that moment. That's just absolutely lovely.
Nice.
I think I can speak over top of it. I just won't be able to hear anybody else.
Would anyone here consider themselves a techno artisan? No. All right, we got one in the back. Excellent.
One back there.
Yeah, whatever.
You can establish trade routes with stations to receive various supplies that your people may need.
Thank you, advisor, for summing up what I was going to say. And we gained a veteracy on someone, I believe. Yes, it was him. But I don't notice, so I won't talk about it anymore. Yeah. Woohoo! I don't know.
Actually, it happened when he was going to E3. He had to turn around and fly back.
And I had to do it by myself. Thanks.
No E3.
No.
Hey.
Oh, yeah. Lena was there.
Yeah. Sorry.
Look, I'm just waiting for the threads criticizing the color shade choices.
Really?
Oh, I'm waiting too.
So yeah, absolutely. That's that's very controversial.
Now there's something you can mod. Go for it.
Record date September 13th, 2014. Live stream and mega panel clips courtesy Civ Games. First 100 turns clips courtesy Solar Gamer. Civilization 4, 5, and Beyond Earth sound clips copyright Take-Two Interactive. Copyright Civilized Communication at civcom.net.